Greetings, and welcome to the Securities Law Briefing. Everything public companies need to know about recent SEC amendments. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press the star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, April 30, 2019. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jay Knight. Please go ahead.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining. My name is Jay Knight, and welcome to the Bass, Berry & Sim Securities Law Briefing on the recently adopted rules. My name is Jay Knight, and I'll be leading today's briefing. It's just a brief introduction, just a little bit about myself. I'm a partner at Bass, Berry & Sim's Corporate and Securities Practice Group, and I head its capital markets sub-practice. And prior to Bass, Berry, joining Bass, Berry in 2012, I previously worked in the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance for approximately 5 years and then worked at another law firm prior to my SEC stint. A little bit about my practice is I focus on representing public companies as either primary securities or M&A counsel or with some companies that are special SEC counsel when complex legal or accounting questions arise or SEC staff involvement may be helpful. For those that are not familiar with our firm, Bass, Berry has approximately 250 lawyers with principal offices in Nashville, D.C., and Memphis, and we are primary securities counsel to more than 40 public companies. I'd also like to take a moment just to plug our securities blog as folks are still dialing in. Bass, Berry, securitieslawexchange.com is the web address, and we feature their commentary and practical insight on SEC updates. And you can subscribe to the blog directly from that website and get updates pushed to you directly. Before we get started with content, let me also mention one more housekeeping item. We've muted all the lines to reduce distraction to all the callers. Therefore, if you have questions during the program, you can use the dial-in email that you received to email directly in to submit questions, or if you'd like to email me directly, you can do that as well. That's jthenight@bassberry.com, and we'll try, you know, to the extent we can, and we'll answer those during the call today, or if for some reason we're not able to, we'll make sure to follow up with you afterward. And also, just note, we'll keep the questioners anonymous to the extent we raise the, you know, we answer the questions on the call today. So let's get started with the program. I'll try to stick to the time. I appreciate everybody's time this afternoon. So as most of you know, the SEC in late March adopted a number of rule updates. According to the SEC's press release, the amendments were intended to benefit investors by eliminating outdated and unnecessary disclosure and making it easier for them to analyze and access material information. For example, for companies, the rules should reduce costs and prep time because of changes like an easier confidential treatment request. And for investors, they no longer have to wade through some outdated information and they'll have an easier time navigating online disclosure documents through hyperlinking. As an overview of the call today, we'll first start off discussing the changes to item 601 of SK, including the simpler confidential treatment request process. Next, we'll look at the expanded hyperlinking requirements. Then we'll discuss some other miscellaneous updates to SK and form cover page changes. Along the way, I'll give some viewpoints on the new rules as well as some potential next steps. Okay, let's turn to the first topic, the changes to 601 of SK. Under current rules, the SEC permits companies to omit immaterial schedules to acquisition agreements filed under 601B2. This had the result of meaning that schedules that were filed for acquisition agreements could be omitted, whereas schedules for material contracts, which are filed under a different item, 601B10, like credit agreements and other material contracts, would not be permitted to omit the schedules. The SEC changed this in the most recent amendments by including a new instruction in 601 that essentially provides that companies no longer are required to file immaterial schedules to the exhibits. Under the new instruction 5 to 601, schedules or similar attachments, which could be exhibits, are not required to be filed provided that they do not contain material, do not contain information material to an investment or voting decision, and that information is not otherwise disclosed in the exhibit or the disclosure document. Each exhibit filed must contain a list briefly identifying the contents of all omitted schedules, but keep in mind that companies do not need to prepare the separate list of omitted information if such information is already included within the exhibit in a manner that conveys the subject matter of the omitted schedules and attachments. And this is usually the case because it'll say, you know, schedule 6.7, it relates to this particular topic, so oftentimes you won't need to have a separate list. Also, the company must provide a copy of any omitted schedule to the commission or its staff upon request. Essentially, these requirements are similar to what was previously required in the acquisition agreement context. This is a welcome change and should help reduce the amount of time it takes to Edgarize material contracts. However, the ability to omit information from exhibits and schedules could result in more pressure in public deals to move key terms to the schedules and exhibits, which then don't need to be filed. But keep in mind, the rules only permit omission of immaterial information. As far as next steps on this particular item, I would, you know, keep the changes in mind as you're drafting future material contracts. And I think there is opportunity, to the extent the information is immaterial, to move it to the schedules and avoid some of the concerns about disclosing competitive information in schedules that are clearly not material to your investors. The next major update to 601 relates to the new confidential treatment request, or CTR process. The amendments simplify the CTR process by allowing companies to omit immaterial confidential information from acquisition agreements filed pursuant to 601B2 of Regulation SK and material contracts filed pursuant to item 601B10 of SK without having to file a concurrent confidential treatment request. These omissions are permitted where the omitted information is not material and would likely cause competitive harm if publicly disclosed. When omitting such information, companies should largely continue to follow the SEC's existing protocols related to labeling confidential information that is omitted from a filing. This includes marking the exhibit index to indicate the portions of the exhibit that have been omitted, including a prominent statement that certain identified information has been excluded from the exhibit because it is both not material and would be competitively harmful if publicly disclosed, and indicating with brackets where the information has been omitted from the filed version. The new CTR process, which essentially flips the burden of proof, whereas it used to be you'd have to submit an application at the time you filed your redacted document with the staff, to now you don't have to include that on the front end, and you only have to prepare it and include it if the staff asks for it later. This new process should be a huge improvement to the prior process of preparing a CTR application at the time of the redacted filing. I suspect this will also greatly free up CorpFin staff resources, as based on my own experience, I know CTRs took up a large chunk of time for the staff. Similar to the omission of immaterial schedules and exhibits, I could see where this may increase some more aggressive redaction of exhibits without the direct staff providing a governor for more aggressive redactions. But we do understand from the staff discussions and their recent SEC Speaks conference that they will be reviewing these disclosures and maybe requesting an application be filed if the omission is questionable or too broad. Overall, this is going to be a major improvement to the CTR process. As far as next steps here, I would say to review any CTRs that are outstanding to determine next steps for extension requests and potential new redactions. There's also a short form application to the extent you have any extensions that are necessary that the staff has made available to help speed up the process on extensions, which do not have the same process. The last major update to 601 relates to what I would call stale material contracts. In summary, existing reporting companies will no longer need to include material contracts that were fully performed within 2 years of the registration statement or report. Only those active material contracts need to be filed. This should help reduce the long list of material contracts for many companies. So, you know, as far as next steps with this, I would review the index in your last 10-K and see where you may have some material contracts that continue to be listed that have been fully performed and are no longer necessary. I think a lot of companies will be doing that as we approach the next 10K cycle. A final update to 601 codified the existing staff practice of permitting registrants to omit personally identifiable information, or PII, from 601 exhibits without a CPR. The next main topic we want to cover today is expanded hyperlinking. As you all know, the SEC previously adopted rules that required exhibits to be hyperlinked. This was a popular rulemaking by many investors because it helped transparency as well as reduced the amount of burden when navigating online filings. As a natural progression of that rulemaking, the SEC amended the incorporation by reference rules in the 33 and 34 Acts in order to expand hyperlinking beyond just exhibits. As revised, the new rules will require registrants to include an active hyperlink to information incorporated by reference into a registration statement or report if such information is publicly available on EDGAR, quote, at the time the registration statement or form is filed. Importantly, this does not apply to forward incorporation by reference information, such as Part 3 of 10-K to the proxy statement and S-3s that incorporate subsequent filings. It applies to only historical filings. Because of some ambiguities in the rule and just implementation questions that have arisen since the rule was adopted, I've actually spoken with the staff a couple times to get some clarity on how these rules apply in specific situations, and I anticipate companies will continue to have questions related to kind of gray areas. So, for example, how does the new requirement apply to information incorporated by reference from one item to another item within the same filing? For example, you have an 8K that covers 1.01, a 2.01, 5.02, and how does that, how does the new hyperlink requirement work there? Or if it's a hyperlink that has, you know, the legal proceedings section of the 10-Q incorporates for reference to the contingencies footnote of the final financial statements. The good news is that the staff has confirmed that a hyperlink would not be required in these examples. In particular, the staff has provided informal interpretive guidance that they believe it is reasonable for companies to interpret the phrase at the time the registration statement or form is filed to mean that such information would need to be on EDGAR prior to the time the registration statement or form is filed. In other words, an active hyperlink would not be required by the new rules if such hyperlink would be the information within the same filing. The staff noted that companies are permitted, if technically feasible, to include such hyperlinks, but that they do not view the rule as requiring this. Another ambiguity in the rule relates to cross-referencing. For example, you know, oftentimes in filings, instead of using the actual words incorporation of reference, the filing will say, you know, for additional information, see this section, or there have not been any material updates to our risk factors since our 10-K, and so go see our 10-K for the material risk, or similar situations. And based on the reading of the rules, along with some other portions of the incorporation for reference changes, we do not believe that a cross-reference and incorporation for reference should be treated the same. For example, new Rule 12b-23b states, quote, in the financial statements incorporating by reference or cross-referencing to information outside of the financial statements is not permitted unless otherwise specifically permitted or required by the Commission's rules or by U.S. GAAP or IFRS. The phrase or cross-referencing to in the above sentence demonstrates that the SEC views incorporating by reference and cross-referencing differently. In contrast, Rule 12b-23d, which is the operative rule related to hyperlinking, omits any reference to cross-referencing. Therefore, unless the registrant specifically incorporates by reference the information from a prior filing, perhaps even using the language explicitly about it being incorporated by reference, it is reasonable to conclude that a hyperlink is not required by the new rules in that situation. So for next steps related to hyperlinking, I would recommend reviewing your existing disclosures to assess where you may need it, where you may need a hyperlink, or in situations where you would currently need a hyperlink, you may want to consider using a different, maybe a cross-referencing if you don't need to hyperlink. And you can address beforehand any questions or issues that are presented as a result. Also, I would make sure the finance teams are aware of the new changes in the incorporation reference rules that cover the financial statements that prohibit cross-referencing or incorporating by reference to information that's outside of the financial statements. I think that's a new change and driven by the auditors in many cases because there's concerns about what information is covered by the audit. And so in order to prevent confusion there, really the financial statements of the F pages will be standing on their own from now on. While I view the exhibit and hyperlinking changes as likely the most significant changes in the new rules, there are a number of other updates that we should cover. Just going down regulation SK in order, item 10 of SK, the amendments remove the prior limitation on incorporating documents more than 5 years old. That was kind of a legacy issue, but that's been removed now. Item 102 of SK related to the description of properties. This was revised to clarify the disclosure about a physical property is only required to the extent that it is material to the registrant. I think this basically just clarifies and reinforces materiality in the item. I don't anticipate that having a large impact to most companies, but the changes could reduce disclosures in some instances. Previously, the item required, disclosure related to like principal and material, and there's a bunch of different standards in there, and now it's just kind of reduced it down and cut out some of the fat, and now it's just kind of discussing if it's material to the registrant. So next steps here, I would review your property disclosures under the new rule to see whether any revisions are appropriate. The next item, SK-202, this relates to the description of the registrant securities. This was previously only a disclosure item for registration statements, but was revised in the new rules to add a new exhibit requirement for Form 10-Ks. The goal the staff was trying to reach was to help investors ease of access to information about the rights and obligations of each class of securities that are registered. Keep in mind, this will only apply to Form 10-K. It does not apply to your upcoming 10-Q. It will require you to kind of assess and cull your existing disclosures on the item with a view for including a new exhibit in the 10-K next year, new exhibit 4 in the 10-K. And this, like I said, this will be a standalone exhibit, and you won't be able to just incorporate by reference from your prior, disclosures. And it also just covers Section 12 registered securities. So, if it's only a 144A transaction that's not a Section 12 registered, then you may be able to not include that, and hopefully that would shorten the list. But like I said, most of those disclosures have been provided. You just have to go find them, and to the extent they need to be updated, just update them for the exhibit. The next item, SK-303, covers MD&A. This was revised slightly to help omit the earliest of the 3 years in the MD&A if it's already included in a prior filing. So basically what you could do in your next 10-K is to cross-reference to the prior filing where the omitted disclosure may be found. So I anticipate a lot of companies will take advantage of this so they can avoid providing, if it's 18, 17, 16, they would avoid providing the 16-17 comparison and just citing to the prior year's disclosure for this information. The next topic is SK-401. And this was relates to executive officer disclosure, and this was revised to make clear that companies do not need to duplicate executive officer disclosure in their definitive proxy statement if they've already provided it in Part 1 of 10-K. Previously, it was a little bit unclear if there was an instruction that already permitted that, but it was not clear that it was with respect to all of the executive officer disclosure. So this was updated to allow companies to have a little more comfort that you could provide all the executive officer disclosure in Part 1 of Form 10-K and would not be, therefore, required to duplicate that in the proxy statement. As far as next steps on that particular one, I would consider whether to rely on this instruction in the future, which could streamline some of the proxy disclosures related to executive officer information. It also updated the caption, if you do exercise this option, to executive officers of the registrant. That's what it used to say. Now it was updated to information about our executive officers. The next item covers Section 16 topics. So we're in SK 405. This was related to compliance with Section 16A of the Exchange Act, and it was revised to clarify that companies may, but are not required, to rely only on Section 16 reports that are filed on EDGAR. Previously, it used to say something in fact that based solely on such reports, but you know, obviously companies would want to take into account their D&O questionnaires and other information when making that assessment. They also changed the rule, item 405, to change the caption heading from Section 16A Beneficial Ownership Reporting Compliance to the more specific, quote, delinquent Section 16A reports, unquote, and also encourage companies, to the extent that there is no delinquent Section 16A filings, to just omit this entirely. For companies that have no Section 16 delinquencies, then there will just not be any disclosure about that in their proxy statement. Other Section 16 changes outside of 405 is staff eliminated in the new rules the requirement for the reporting persons to furnish Section 16 reports to the registrant. They also eliminated the checkbox on the cover page of the 10-K and that related to delinquent Section 16 filings. In my opinion, that was a pretty poorly worded checkbox that was confusing to read, and so really they just, you know, omitted that and just to kind of simplify the disclosures. And now you would only include disclosure about delinquent Section 16 filings to the extent you have any in your proxy statement. The next item, 407, this is corporate governance update. This covers your audit committee report and your compensation committee report. So for the audit committee report, there was an outdated citation to an accounting standard that has been subsequently changed. In order to avoid, most companies have fixed that on their own in their reports or to the new accounting standard or just been more generic. In order to not have to track the rules all the time for whatever the accounting literature provides, then now the reference is more broadly to the applicable requirements of the PCAOB and the commission. Like I said, most companies have already updated this, but there is greater ability now to cite to the rule itself to the language that you're looking for if you prefer to go with the language that is provided in the rules. It also clarifies that the compensation committee report does not need to be provided for emerging growth companies. This was already known, but the rules really hadn't caught up from the prior changes in the statute. Even so, there are a number of EGCs that provide this comp committee report voluntarily, but this gives a little more color and ability for EGCs to not include that and cite the provision in the rule that permits that if they so choose. A few items on the kind of a capital market side is SK 501 was amended. This changes some of the prospectus cover page. I won't dive into this too much, but essentially there was, if you had an offering price that was determined by a formula, you used to have to include all of the formula information on your prospectus cover page, and that could drag on for a long time and be confusing to investors on the cover page. And so that now it's just reduced to you just include a simple statement that the price is determined by a formula and then just cite to the portion of the prospectus where the more fulsome disclosure is contained. There's a couple other changes, too, related to the prospectus cover page, but I won't really get into those today. I'm happy to provide more detail, and there's more detail on our blog for those. But for the most part, it's pretty unique situations where those would occur. So moving on to SK 503, this used to be where the risk factors was housed, and the risk factors now have been moved entirely into a new item 105. And it largely keeps the risk factor requirements intact. It just deletes. There used to be some boilerplate examples that I think had been in the rules since 1964. And so a lot of companies were kind of tracking those boilerplate examples. And so the staff, in order to kind of make it really more principles-based and to discourage just kind of a boilerplate, change the rule to delete those boilerplate examples. So I don't really think this will impact your risk factors for the most part or for most companies, but it's something to keep in mind. And to the extent you were tracking those boilerplate examples, you may want to refresh those or at least revisit whether or not that's appropriate or not. A couple other items here. The SK 508 was related to plans of distribution, and that was amended to add a definition of sub-underwriter. That's a pretty unique situation, but, you know, that previously was mentioned but not defined. Also in SK 512, this is the undertakings item. This was amended to eliminate some obsolete undertakings. For example, in your registration statements, like an S3, there'll be some different undertakings in your next one that you would file that would remove some of the obsolete ones. A couple other updates to the cover pages for 10K, 10Q, and 8K. So these go effective live on Thursday to now include the title of each class of securities, the trading symbol, and the name on each exchange on which it's registered. As you recall, the Form 10K already has a table that includes the title of the cover page, the title of each class of securities, and the name on each exchange on which is, the class is registered. And this adds a new trading symbol in that table, and then also applies that table across the 10K, 10Q, and 8K. So your next steps here would be to prepare the updated cover pages on your system so that they're ready to go. And to the extent you were filing on Thursday or after, you would be updating on the second or after, you'd be updating the form 10Q and 8K and 10K to include that information. So now that we've talked about the substantive amendments, let's talk effective dates. For the CTR changes, those took effect on April 2nd, which was effective immediately upon their publication in the Federal Register, so those are already in effect. For everything else, those are effective on Thursday, May 2nd, except for certain rules for investment companies and the tagging of cover pages for inline XBRL. For inline XBRL cover page tagging, the compliance dates sync with the dates previously established for compliance with the inline XBRL rules. A couple other items. I think that really covers the broad swath of the rules that were adopted in the most recent batch of amendments. I guess before we close out, I just want to flag a few new items just to be aware of as they're coming down the pike. So SEC has said that Rule 305 proposals should be coming very soon. So the Rule 305 of SX is the item that requires acquisition financials of significant targets. So if it's a acquisition and the acquiree is of significant size, 20% plus based on the significant test outlined in 305. 305 has been a headache for a lot of companies, and it kind of creates anomalous results, and we've had to go in for waivers for a number of companies and clients. In fact, I have a call in a couple hours with the staff on a waiver request for 305. And so there's supposed to be amending those rules, and the proposal for that rule is supposed to be coming out, I'm told, very soon. So maybe within the next month or so, we should see a proposal out for the 305 amendments. The other items, just to be aware of, is 310 of SX and 316. And the next stage for those is a final adoption. And those 310 is the one that provides guarantor financials for companies that have registered debt or securities of a guarantor. And so there's a footnote that's required in financial statements that is fairly burdensome to produce. And so the staff is expected to help reduce the burden, compliance burden for that one. The information really is not material in certain circumstances. The other one is testing the waters for all registrants. That next action for that is final rule, and I anticipate that later this year. The comment period closed yesterday on the proposal that the staff had issued for testing the waters for all companies. And then I'm told also there's a private placement concept release that's in the works, basically to try to synchronize and make sense of the hodgepodge of different private placement exemptions that are out there, and to try to provide some harmony to, you know, the rules in the private placement space. So I would anticipate sometime this year a concept release related to private placements. In conclusion, I want to thank each of you for listening to today's Securities Law Briefing teleconference, and I hope you have found it helpful as you're preparing your SEC filings. If you have submitted a question during the program and I wasn't able to address it, I want to make sure that you know that I'll follow up with you after the call. Or for future questions on these SEC changes or for any other questions, I'll give my contact information. My email address is jthenight@bassberry.com, and my phone number is 615-742-7756. Again, thank you for participating in today's teleconference, and have a great rest of your day. This concludes the teleconference. Thank you.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.